Behind the Lines, the Houston Lawyer Podcast. I am your host, Anna Archer. This episode corresponds with a parents-in-law issue of the Houston Lawyer magazine. The episode has two titles to reflect that the content is valuable to different types of listeners for different reasons. For lawyers, the title is Making the Most of Your Parenting Years While Maintaining a Successful Legal Career. For legal employers, the title is Retaining Healthy and Happy Parent Lawyers. While the episode focuses on parent lawyers and legal employers, other lawyers will benefit from listening by having a better understanding of their colleagues' experiences. The first segment features parents of younger children. Then, after a brief wellness break, the next two segments feature parents of children in their tweens, teens, and 20s, and an adoptive parent. The final segment spotlights Houston Volunteer Lawyers' guardianship partnership with Houston Young Lawyers Association. Before moving on to these interesting and enlightening segments, I would like to thank all of the wonderful guests in this episode who took the time to be interviewed for this podcast, the editorial board of the Houston Lawyer, the podcast committee, and the very helpful HBA staff. Now, let's go behind the lines. The first panel today addresses, specific to lawyers, practicing while parenting young children, and for firms, what support your young lawyer parents need. We have three amazing panelists who are all successfully balancing having young children with thriving law practices. I would first like to introduce Marianne Zaki. Marianne earned her undergraduate degree in international relations at Boston University and her law degree from University of Houston Law Center. She has worked at small, medium, and big law firms. She has recently started her own firm, Zaki Law PLLC, where she is assisting individuals and companies with their legal needs, and she's also interested in coaching other women in law. Marianne has three wonderful little girls, aged 6, 4, and 1. Thank you for joining Behind the Lines, Marianne.
Thank you for having me.
Next is Sarah Prasadic. Sarah is an attorney at the law firm of Wilson, Cribbs & Gorham, PC, where she focuses her practice on commercial, real estate, and land use litigation. She is wife to Josh, who is also an attorney, and they are parents to three kids, ages 8, 5, and 3. Sarah attended the University of Houston Law Center and also holds a Master of Divinity from Princeton Theological Seminary and a bachelor's degree in political science from the George Washington University. When Sarah's not in the courtroom, you can usually find her at one of her kids' soccer games or swim meets. Thank you for joining us on Behind the Lines, Sarah.
It's great to be here, Anna.
And last but not least is Carrie Brown. Carrie is a partner at Baker Botts, who focuses on complex federal estate, gift, and income tax litigation and controversy matters. She counsels high net worth individuals and families, represents taxpayers in audits and appeals, and assists businesses and individuals who are navigating the litigation process and tax matters. Carrie also serves as Baker Botts' first global partner in charge of corporate social responsibility. Carrie earned her undergraduate degree in speech communication at Texas A&M and her law degree at South Texas College of Law, Houston. She has two adorable young children, ages 9 and 7. We are so glad you could join us today on Behind the Lines.
Thanks, Anna. Hi, everyone.
So we're going to jump right into our first topic, which is about practicing law while parenting. We actually have an article in the upcoming issue of the Houston Lawyer that corresponds with this episode of the podcast about the best practices for maternity leave. And I'm wondering what your experiences with maternity leave are, and if there's anything you think firms could do to make it easier on brand new moms when it's time to return to work. Let's start with Carrie.
So, yeah, this is no softballs, right? my experience coming back from leave was not the same as everyone else's. And I think it's primarily because the practice I'm in is a small practice. And so I did not experience what I commonly hear of, I'm having trouble getting ramped back up because, other people have taken this work while I was out and now they don't want to take it from them and give it back over to me. So I didn't really have that issue with, oh no, where are my hours going to come from? And so maybe Marianne or Sarah might be able to address that. But in terms of coming back from leave, what firms can do, one of the things that is really nice is my firm has expanded its parental leave policy, first of all, from back when, my children were born in the Stone Ages, 7 and 9 years ago. And it is now much more generous and I think much more equitable in terms of giving new parents and, let's be honest, mostly new moms, more time that they need when they are just getting started with the new kid. I came back early from my first parental leave because of the way that our parental leave structure was set up. I was actually somewhat incentivized to come back early. I mean, I only came back a week early, but it was still early. And so I was able to benefit from a particular structure we had at the time. And I was able to leave an 11-week-old at home because I had good supports available at home in terms of who was taking care of my child. And so, from the perspective of the firm, I think they did everything that they should have. I had what I needed to reintegrate, and there really weren't any issues with getting my work back up to speed. Now, where I do see some issues sometimes with some lawyers returning from parental leave, and this is one of the reasons why I think that a lot of non-childbearing parents maybe don't take as much parental leave, is that you don't want to lose the clients. If you're a young associate, you don't want to lose the partners who come to rely on you. And so you sort of skimp out on your parental leave just to be there, to be able to say yes, so you can advance your career. And I think that what's important for the firms here is to really take a concerted effort in making sure that the lawyers returning from leave are reintegrated appropriately. Sometimes that is just staying involved throughout the term of the leave, which I am not suggesting that anyone has to do. It was something that worked for me, given where I was and the kind of practice that I have. I was able to at least just read the emails as they came through, so I wasn't coming in blind when I came back. So I think staying involved in the matters as the person on leave definitely can help. And from the firm, they have to make the effort to make sure that the lawyer is getting the support they need and getting reintegrated. And not just put lip service on it, not just say we have a reintegration partner who's going to help you, but actually make sure that it's happening and that the lawyer isn't getting looked over for work just because they've been out and they're not up to speed on the deal. You just have to get them up to speed on the deal.
I think that's a great suggestion. And also, you're talking a little bit about how your firm has an equitable policy for dads and moms who are taking parental leave. And I feel like when I was working in private practice, that the dads were like, we had a policy, but the dads kind of felt they really weren't supposed to take that leave, even though it was available to them. Have you noticed any of that, or has that kind of gotten better in the past several years?
Yes and yes. It absolutely happens. It still happens. It has gotten better, but maybe now instead of the person who didn't give birth to the child taking off only a week or 2 weeks, they're taking off maybe 3 or 4. And whenever I see them taking 4 weeks, I am so grateful. I want to applaud them. Thank you for taking that time. Right. I frankly like it even better if they take maybe a few weeks at the front end, like when the baby first gets home, and then maybe they're able to take some leave when mom has to go back to work. Right. And then you kind of get to ladder in that time with the new baby, because I also think, look, it's pretty cool to be the person that's responsible for the day to day, caring, feeding of this tiny little squawking, colicky, messy being in whom you're going to impart all your wisdom, And I also just tend to think the longer you can keep them home, this is my personal bias, the better. So it is still an issue, Anna, and I always encourage our, the men who, their wife or their significant other just had a baby. I'm like, take as much time as you want to take. The work will be here. I don't have the authority to say the work will be here in every case, but to the extent I have the authority, I'm like, the work's going to be here. Go take your time. Be with your tiny little spawn who is going to suck you dry of all of your money and your affection and your love. and do it now because you've only got them at home for 18 years.
I can concur with that because I'm a mother of older children who have now flown the nest and it goes by. And I know everybody tells you this, but so fast. So that is true. And I think it's a very good tip for not just the like managing partners, but other people in firms that do have the power to distribute work to know they would be great and helpful if they encouraged fathers and mothers to take that time with their families because they're going to have more fulfilled workers. So Mary Ann, I want to move on to you with this same question. Your experience, I'm sure, was a little bit different than Carrie's. And maybe you were, I don't even know if you were at the same firm for all three kids. I think maybe you changed firms in the process. So I think you'll have a lot of good wisdom to impart there. So what do you think?
I definitely have a lot of thoughts. And first of all, so appreciate everything that Carrie has said. It's so refreshing when you hear about firms who, you know, really practice what they preach. And I know it's not perfect in every scenario, but at least when the intent there is to make it a good working environment for people before and after leave, I think that's what we can all hope for. I'm curious to read the article in the Houston Lawyer because this is something I've always thought about. And I've always kind of thought to myself that sometimes firms will just say, oh, great, look, now we have a 20-week maternity leave policy. Look how wonderful we are, right? But, you know, before and after the maternity leave is a complete and utter disaster. And, you know, I think there's this tendency, I think, for some firms to kind of flaunt how long they give people for maternity leave. And then maybe, you know, say that they have some ramp up and ramp down programs. But just having a long maternity leave definitely does not equate with the firm being supportive of women and working parents. So, you know, I mentioned the ramp up, ramp down thing that was present at one of the firms that I took maternity leave at. I think in theory, it was really a good idea. But I think firms have to really hold themselves to it. You know, are you really giving people ramp down time or are you assigning them new cases, you know, the week before their due date, right? Same thing when they come back from leave. Are you giving them that grace and that time to get readjusted? Or, you know, is the day that they come back, you're saying, hey, there's a appellate brief due in 1 week. So I think, you know, those are just, you know, considerations to have in mind. I will say I was at one firm who I think did a really great job in terms of providing resources when I returned back from leave. For example, a separate nursing room where I could go and pump in privacy. I've also received the total opposite end of that, where I had to kind of pump in a wellness room that, you know, sometimes there would be people taking naps during the day and people would be knocking to try to use the wellness room at the same time. So, you know, those are just kind of things that people and firms should keep in mind. And I guess another what not to do is, you know, don't email your associates or partners when they're out on maternity leave with potential job opportunities. And I hate to say it, but this is a true story. And, you know, I think really respecting people's leave periods and not making them work through maternity leave, not making them really think about, hey, is my job going to be there when I get back? So I hate to say it, it's 2022. I would have hoped that, you know, we would have not still be having some of these issues and concerns, but I think talking about them and pointing out ways that the system could be better is definitely how we make some progress.
As far as the nursing, good news on that front, there's also going to be an article in this issue about that. So there's going to be something about where you can go, a list for where nursing rooms are at local courthouses, and then kind of what the rules are as far as providing that to employees. So, which, you know, there aren't awesome. Very many, but some states do actually have some laws from what I recall of this article. I'm going to just refer you all to the article because I did not write it, but I think it's going to be very helpful to young mothers. So, and as far as your firm policies, I think that there's a concern with mothers when they take leave and fathers that you might be missing out on something or somehow delaying your career progression because you need to take leave. And in reality, if firms want to support young parents, it would be great to find a way to where you don't have to feel like your career is going to be put on hold because you're having a child. So
yeah, I might pop in here a little bit just because I think, you know, my experience, I know Mary Ann's experience well, and I know Carrie's background, and I've worked at different firms and different size firms. And some of that was calculated on my part in that my two cents is that a lot of times the maternity leave issue is sort of the tip of the iceberg. It's a very fixed place and time where firms have to acknowledge that people have a family and life outside of work. And that's why, you know, they're quick to say, what can I do to fix that? Well, we can make it longer. We can actually pay you for all of it. Those kinds of things. But really the underlying issue is just this, is the culture of work and family and acknowledging that and having the opportunity to do that. And so, you know, I've worked in a couple of different circumstances. I had one firm where I didn't get any leave. I just had to take unpaid time off. My current firm has got, you know, policy, and it's based on all the insurance stuff and what they can give you off. But what I will say, as a practice pointer is when the firm leadership and management, as well as the men and the women who are at the firm with older kids, can be involved in their kid's life, not just because it's considered a medical event by insurance and that they've got to require some time off, you know, in an extra week or two if it was a surgical delivery or if it wasn't. And so I think that's really what I see is sort of underlying this whole discussion and animating some of the frustrations is if one of my colleagues is coaching baseball on Tuesday nights and I know he's got to be at the field at 5:30 and he can talk about that, well, then I can talk about I need a break because I'm still pumping. You know, it just, there's an opportunity there. And I think that's what I hear in the echoes of Carrie's encouragement of the dad saying, taking time off is that really it's this culture of acknowledging in a very real way on a consistent basis that we've got families. And when there's a birth, that is the first chapter of that. And so something that, you know, I valued in my last leave was is that I didn't get a phone call. And when I did, I got one and it was a profuse apology. I'm so, so sorry. Please call me if you can, when you can. I've got this one question. And I knew the answer and had to answer it because it was my client and had to pick something up. But, you know, that was an indication of their willingness to take it on because they knew that when they wanted to take vacation in a couple of months, when I came back, I would chip in and do the same thing. And so what you do is it's a great thing to talk about with an maternity leave, but part of the cultural expectation of the firm and that having an on-ramp and off-ramp, isn't it? If it were, it'd be 18 years long, right? Because that's how long we have kids. So, you know, I really think part of the conversation that I feel strongly about is it's got to be, it may be the first time someone's had to navigate those challenges and it really is a punctuation mark in their career. But the more that we acknowledge our colleagues and our friends or parents and, or they may have other responsibilities outside of life and we're not just playing lip service to that, the more it makes sense to have maternity leave and you acknowledge and respect it and you have confidence that when that person comes back, because of the trust that they put in, they're going to jump back in to the extent they can. You've got a much better culture for advancing that. And so I would say one of the things that I've seen happen, because when I announced I was pregnant with my last child at my firm, I was the fourth attorney and we only had like 25 lawyers. So the fourth attorney within a 3-week period who announced a pregnancy. So that meant all of our leave was going to overlap, right? And everyone was met with the same enthusiasm. That's awesome. Congratulations. We'll figure it out, you know, and that's a very different posture than like, oh man, they're going to leave us high and dry. Who's going to pick up their work? Who's going to handle all the continuances? You know, I do trial work. So if I'm not there for a hearing, someone's got to cover it. You know, there's only a few judges in town who will take seriously the maternity leave notice. The others I've got to, you know, say, hey, I've got to file something new every time that says, whoa, whoa, whoa. Well, if you ask a mom who is her second week home, on maternity leave that she could get a continuance if she needs one, if she signs a verification or a motion, well, you've just ended the maternity leave because I've got to find a computer with a baby to file a motion. And so, you know, stuff like that, if you've got the confidence of the firm that knows, okay, well, when we step in, that means we've got to cover their cases and get the continuances on file and support that and animate that. You know, all of those things are in play. It starts to feel like it's possible to do it. Rather than an impossible amount of guilt to try to keep up with the work and then also figure out what to do with this first tiny human, or in my case, the third, while the other two are sort of climbing all over me at the same time.
So
I mean, I think that's a big thing.
I think your tip, Sarah, about the court is really an important one. And I know that some judges in town have a special maternity leave procedure. So if you are a judge and listening to this, adopt one, or if you don't know what it is, you can contact me because I know what it is. So, Carrie, you wanted to say something?
I do. Sarah reminded me of something when she was talking about this, you know, the judge requiring you to attest, et cetera, for a continuance. Let me give a practice tip. This was not on Anna's agenda. I'm going off script. Practice tip for those of you who are working at your opposing counsel is on maternity, parental leave. I was literally in the hospital unexpectedly because my child had to be induced. And then I ended up with an emergency C-section. I'm literally in labor on the day that I have discovery due. And so I email opposing counsel and I say, hello, I am in the hospital. I've been induced. I am giving birth to a human. May I please have a 1 week extension?
You only ask for 1 week.
On the discovery requests that are due today. And the male opposing counsel's response was, I have no objection to your 1 week extension so long as you will give me the same on my discovery requests. And at the moment, I was just like, fine, whatever. But in hindsight, I'm a little bit flabbergasted because I would never say no to a reasonable request for an extension. But the fact that I email you and say, I am literally in labor, I would like a week, please. Just give it an unconditional yes. Best wishes, good luck, congratulations on the baby, and let it go. That is not the time to ask for a quid pro quo on your discovery requests. This was not almost 10 years ago, and I still remember it. So please don't be that person. That's it, Anna. I'm done on that.
I totally get it. So Mary Ann, I want to move on to the next topic. So you've recently transitioned from Big Law to starting up your own firm. And I was wondering if you could offer some advice to young moms who may be at a firm, maybe not even Big Law, but any firm, and it's not really working out for some of the reasons we've discussed, but other reasons as well, like what Sarah was talking a lot about, firm culture, and sometimes it's just not the right culture for you. So I was wondering if you could give some tips on young moms who are considering changing career paths and also advice to firms who may be losing young moms on how to retain them.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Anna. And, you know, I'm, I guess, 3 months into this venture as a solo practice attorney. And I think today is such a great day to be reflecting on this because we're traveling tomorrow for Thanksgiving to see my family. And before this call, I was thinking, okay, I've sent my invoices out to my few clients that, you know, I'm so thankful for. I've, you know, cleared up my emails. I've packed our bags. You know, I feel like I'm in a good spot to travel tomorrow. And I can just tell you that for the past 10 years, the day before Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving break, if we were going to travel, I'm usually a wreck. I mean, I'm getting emails from partners who knew that I was going to be out of town, but are still asking me to do things, you know, just feeling like my life was completely spiraling out of control, to be honest. And I think what I've just realized today, but also over the past 3 months, is just a reminder to people that regardless of where you work, whatever firm it is, if you feel like it's not working, you know, there might be things on your end, yes, that you might need to self-reflect and say, okay, you know, am I taking this constructive feedback to heart and am I improving and am I doing all the things that the firm is asking me to say? 100%. You know, there's always a time and place for looking inwards and figuring out what can you do to be better and to meet the firm's expectations. But I think so many women and men alike, right, we feel we're doing all of the right things, but we're still not meeting whatever the criteria or quota is. And I guess what I want to say is it's not you. It's not always you. I've always felt kind of I'm this puzzle piece and I'm trying to fit into a puzzle, but the puzzle doesn't fit me. You know, I value XYZ. I want to work on XYZ. This is how I see cases and how they should be handled. And you just kind of have to remember that although women have been welcomed into the profession, although women have been welcomed into these law firms, they weren't built to accommodate, you know, people who need to go out for 4 months to recover from, you know, birthing a human, like Carrie said, you know. So it's not always you. Sometimes it's just the system, and sometimes the system can feel completely broken, which is why, you know, we're having this conversation today to try to figure out what we can do to do better. So I think those are kind of the things that I would say. It's not always you. And just remember that there are so many options out there. I think that's what I've learned the most over the past 3 months is I always felt, okay, if I leave big law or if I leave these big law firms, you know, I'm a mess. You know, I might as well never have gone to law school. My career is a complete bust. But, you know, you can go in-house to work for a company. You can go work at another firm. I mean, all firms are different. You can go solo, which is what I've decided to do. And I've realized, hey, you know, I have a law degree just like everybody else that I was working with. And I don't necessarily need a huge institution behind me to practice law and to do a really good job at it. So that's just something that, you know, I've realized. And it sounds so obvious when I say it that you have a law degree just like everybody else. But I think so often we tie our identity to being lawyers at firms. And we can't imagine a scenario where we might break free from that and still be successful. But Anna, thanks to you, you put me in touch with some great solo practitioners who have done it, and they've showed me that it is possible. And so that has been an inspiration. I guess to the second part about what law firms can do to retain associates, I think we've kind of talked a little bit about it in terms of, you know, the maternity leave context. But I think kind of similar to what Carrie and Sarah have said is, Be flexible. You know that the mom that's coming back from maternity leave isn't all of a sudden going to bill, you know, 2,500 hours that year, right? You know, she's trying to juggle now being a mom. Daycare, you know, closes all of the time. They have sick children, but they still love being a lawyer. They still are so grateful for the opportunity to work on cases. So I think firms really need to adopt a long-term approach here. I think firms, for financial reasons or whatever, get caught up in, oh dear, if this associate bills less than 2,000 hours a year, we got to let them go. And, you know, I was even doing some simple math before this podcast, but, you know, even if a new mom comes back to work and bills $500, if the firm is billing them out at $500 an hour, right? If that attorney works 1,500 hours that year, the firm still makes $750,000, which at least in my experience is more than I've ever made as a law firm associate. So I think just reanalyzing that profitability might look different for a year or two, but in the long run, I really believe that women deserve a seat at the table. And ultimately, I think it affects firms' long-term growth when they don't see that potential in the short term. So those are my thoughts.
I love the point about going to other women to mentor you and encourage you and support you when you're making a transition in your career, because obviously there are other women who have done it. So it's really helpful to know that there's a network out there if you do need to make a transition of people that can help. And secondly, as far as the firms, so it sounds like kind of they need to realize the value of what they have instead of looking at the short-term dollar signs, realizing what they've invested in you so far and how much you have to offer in the long run. So that's just my kind of summing up what you were talking about. So I want to ask Carrie, because you've had a really successful time as a parent in big law. And I was wondering if I know that, as you mentioned earlier, you're in a kind of a smaller practice group. I'm wondering how your practice group specifically has supported you as a parent, and if somehow that has contributed to your decision to remain in big law all this time.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed right away in my practice, I graduated from law school in 2006, and my first child was born in 2013. So I had a lot of time in between there to just kind of observe. And one of the things I observed was, you know, when I started, we had three partners in my section, all of whom were male. And then within a year, one woman made partner. So there were, you know, three male partners and one woman partner for all, you know, for all intents and purposes while I was an associate. And the men who still had children in school left and went to the games. And they went on the, you know, we're going on a college trip. We're going on a, you know, they've got a lacrosse game or a field hockey or water hockey or all these strange sports that I did not grow up with. You know, they've got softball, this and that. And they coached their kids when they were in the younger ages. And they really set a good precedent for you can go and do these things with your kids and we are not going to bat an eye at it. Now, you still have to get your work done. So, you know, that I hope goes without saying, but I just said it. So whatever. But, you know, it was nice to know even, you know, 6-7 years before I had a kid that these people who are judging me, you know, also, you know, take the time to make sure that they are with their kids and they are part of their kids' lives. And so I think that was a really nice precedent that they set. Now, to your second part of the question, has it contributed me staying? Well, I don't know, because I don't know any different, right? I have heard stories that make me believe that not everyone at my firm is quite as welcoming of taking time to make sure you're getting done with what you need to get done with. But I can also say that if we have any of those folks, they are few and far between. So, you know, I can't say that having good precedent set has made me stay there, because I think I would have had to, you know, did I have any really crappy partners who were like, no, you can't do that because you have to get this done. And did I leave in that case? So, you know, I don't know how to answer that. Maybe I would have left if they were like, no, you can't go do this. But I also had this sort of innate, first of all, I wasn't ready to have children when I, you know, first graduated law school. And more power to those of you who do it, but I think that's crazy. I had time to build my reputation. You know, one of the things I tell new lawyers, this is irrespective of whether you're having children, but the very first time you do work for anyone, that should be the absolute best work product you can put together, because you want to set the good example. You want them to know that you can be relied on, you do good work, you're effective, you're timely, et cetera. And so I also sort of translated that into, you know, not only was I not ready to have children until I was really, frankly, in my mid-30s, I also wanted the people that I work with to have come to rely on me, so that I sort of made myself harder to replace. Nobody's irreplaceable, but, you know, I did what I could to make myself hard to replace. You know, do a good job, make them want to give you work, and then it also makes it a lot easier when you go out on leave to remain connected to the work and have the work back on your desk when you come back. So it's a non-answer of an answer, Anna, but that's the best I can do.
So it depends. So actually what you were saying in the beginning, though, about your firm was kind of what Sarah was saying as well earlier about the firm culture and kind of the partners showing you that it's okay to be involved in your family because they're involved in their family. And so that makes you feel more supported. And I don't think that all partners in all firms, whether it's big, small, medium, whatever, do that even when they have partners. Sometimes the signals they give you are, you wonder, do they even have a family, because it's all about work. So it's kind of nice tip for the firms to let your younger parents know that you have a family too, and that it's important to you if that's the type of culture you want to have in your firm and you want to encourage young lawyers to stay. So Sarah, is there anything that you think other firms could learn from what your firm's done right, besides what we've kind of already talked about in supporting you as a lawyer mom?
Well, sure. You know, part of what drew me to the firm I'm at here, is besides the people I like, is just that they are trying to cultivate a culture of sustainable life. So it's not just, can you do it for a year, but can you do it for 20 years? And no one's promising that anywhere they go. No one can promise that. But there's just been sort of a longer view cast there, which I think is a really good view for someone who wants to have a family and actually have a lot of points of intersection with their kids' lives, because there's a lots of different ways to be a part of your family. For me, it means more than just pick up and drop off. I need to be able to go to the assembly. I need to be able to be the one to take them to the doctor's appointment. I want to be home at dinner time, not just on Sundays, but on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, unless I'm in trial. And I say that because those are very concrete. And so, you know, being able to get all the work done and having flexibility can sometimes look like being on call 24/7. And as long as you get it done, it doesn't matter if it's between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. kind of attitude, or is it really a sustainable amount of work? But yes, I'm up till 2 a.m. sometimes. And yes, when I'm in trial, everything's off the rails at home and otherwise, right? But most of the time, you know, is it a sustainable amount of work? And that comes both with the expectations, you know, regardless of whether the attorneys are parents. But it also plays a role for when you become a parent, because you can sort of figure out how to navigate that and fit that in. And I think in some ways, what smaller and mid-sized firms may have in terms of their nimbleness allows for some of that more immediately. There's not as many gears to grind, as many people that have to agree. So some of those changes can maybe happen a little bit more immediately with particular circumstances. So I appreciate that. At the same time, there's actually nowhere else for the work to go if I'm out. And so, you know, some of that presents its own challenges. But I was going to say something about being a lawyer and a parent, being a mom, is a high level of trust. There are some people who need to see all of the lawyers at their firm every day in their chair, saluting in whatever way that might be, and waiting. I would say that one of the great things about COVID is somehow, some way, people figured it out. Even culturally, that we're used to having everyone in the building face to face. For me as a mom, who my youngest was not even 1 year old when all the schools closed and the daycares and the nannies didn't come anymore, it was a huge sea change, even for someone like me in a small firm, to have, I couldn't excuse anymore. I couldn't like be discreet about having kids to my clients, lawyers opposing counsel. And it was just sort of like this aha moment. Even lawyers who don't really have as many touch points in their kids' lives had those in a way they didn't. And I would call men who I didn't even know had kids, and I'd hear kids. Oh, those are kids. Yeah. So-and-so's in the backyard. So-and-so's by the TV. You know, we're doing the iPad shuffle with classes. I say all of this because something that I saw happen that was happening at my firm anyway, started happening other places too, was just, I didn't have to apologize. Listen, I'm going to be, I'll hop on that call. I've got pickup today. I'll be on it. Just trust me that I'm going to be there. This is a long way around of really instilling and trust in your young parents. Something Carrie said about her reputation, it's not just the quality of your work, but if they give it to you, they can trust that you're going to come through with it, and expecting that, and then not tasking people with it. Because I know part of what moms do and they learn how to do very quickly is shuffle all the things around, juggle, manage. You know, can you take a conference call at the grocery store, you know, checkout? Yes, you can. You know, learn how to mute your phone. Those kinds of things. But, you know, that takes on, that also requires a high level of trust. And that's not something that happens easily with any employee, but even more so when you may not have the same face time. And so I say all of that because what I think is a really something that I've really valued through COVID, but then just before and after, is that level of trust that it's my client, or I'm working on somebody else's case with them. They trust that I'm going to do it. And so then when something happens and a kid is sick, they know that, you know, they can trust your assessment of whether you're going to get it done. And know when you're going to need to raise a flag and say, I need help, or say, I've got it. It's just going to be 9 o'clock. I'll call you at 9:30 when I'm done. And that high level of trust, I think, lends itself well to being flexible for parents, especially young parents of young children, when the demands are immediate and real and physical, or when they're older and they're starting their first football game. I've got to be there from 7 to 9, you know, those kinds of commitments and knowing about that. But I say that because the flexibility is only as good as the trust that people have for one another in a firm environment. And if the trust depends on having them physically in the chair and physically standing over a shoulder to get a work product done, you haven't created a culture of trust. And so, of course, you're going to be skeptical when someone's been gone for 3 months. You haven't laid eyes on them. I don't know what you were doing for the last 3 months on your maternity vacation, but we've got a bunch of stuff happening back here. And the difference between that and, hey, you're back. We're so glad you're here. We're ready for you to jump in. You know, here's what we've got cooking. I need you here and here. Let me know. It's just that level of, you hired me for a reason, or we're partners for a reason. That trust has got to be there. And then when you start dealing with kids stuff, it's just one more piece of it. It might as well be a dentist appointment. Not that that's of the same significance, but when someone goes to a doctor's appointment, you trust they're going to come back. You trust that they're going to figure out to juggle their calls and the schedule. And just because it comes with a kid attached to it doesn't mean there should be any less trust there. And that's huge. And so something I say that's successful here that I really value where I am at this point in stage is just that's real, not just an idea or a policy or a concept. It's just, well, we trusted you when you walked in to get it done. And we didn't ask you when you were going to come, and we didn't ask you when you were going to leave, and just knew that if it didn't get done, the proof's in the pudding, so to speak. We'll know then.
That kind of goes with what Carrie was saying about building your reputation before you have kids, if possible. I mean, I know when I started at the law firm, I already had kids, but if you can mm-hmm. do that and they already know that you're on top of things, then why wouldn't that trust continue afterwards? So we don't have much time, we're running out of time, but I do want to get from you some tips on that kind of elusive work-life balance thing. So what tips do you have, Mary Ann, for parents who are struggling to balance their responsibilities as parents with their demands at the firm?
Definitely. Well, I think the first thing is to take a deep breath. Your wellness, your sanity, your ability to stay in this profession long-term is so important. And I think just taking that moment to take a deep breath, first of all, and get that oxygen in and just pause, you know, the world, even if your kids are screaming and the partner's emailing you and in your mind, you're just like, I cannot handle this anymore. Close your eyes, take a deep breath. Everything is going to be okay. And I think I touched on this a little earlier, but I have it somewhere here, but I think I have my gold bar card, which any of us who, you know, have been admitted into the bar, it's this gold card. And I think the coolest thing, you know, there were days where actually many days or weeks or years of my career so far where I've thought to myself, this was the worst decision I ever made in my life to go to law school. You know, there are times that, you know, college students would reach out to me, hey, you know, I'm thinking about law school, should I go? And there are days that I was just like, you know, no, I really don't think so. You know, this is a profession where you're working 24/7. I mean, I wasn't always that honest, but I had those feelings. And now that I've been on my own for the past few months, I think having this bar card is the coolest thing ever. I mean, I've had clients call and say, hey, I'm in this really tough spot. I'm in this, you know, situation. What should I do? And the ability to tell them, you know, these are your rights under Texas law. These are the options that you can, you know, take. And I just think being able to help people and to have, you know, the state bar's stamp of approval that we're qualified to walk people through those situations is the coolest thing. And also just knowing that there's so many different areas of law. I mean, I know Sarah's, you know, more of a trial lawyer. Our practices are a little different here, but the coolest thing is me realizing, okay, if I want to learn more about employment law and maybe do that, okay, great. You know, I can do it. I'll have to take the CLEs and get up to speed, but I can do it. If I want to learn trademark law, I can do it, you know? And so I think just my advice is just know that there are so many options out there and really the world is your oyster and you just have to figure out what interests you and, you know, keeps you excited, because I think it's an exciting profession to be a part of and we're all privileged to be a part of it. So those are my two cents.
Thanks, Mary Ann. Very well said. What about you, Sarah? Any quick tips for work-life balance?
Well, this may be obvious, but for me, it's picking a good partner in life to do it with, because I would be absolutely, we'd be crazy in my house without my husband involved. And he's also a lawyer. So there are days where things are tricky and hard, but that makes a big difference. And I think by extension is figuring out who your support network is. And I do better at that at different seasons, but something that is important, I think Mary Ann talked about getting mentors, but finding at least one other person who is in as a lawyer, who is got kids, just to have a sounding board, if for nothing more, or word of encouragement is huge. And I think any of us on this podcast would love to do that. So if you're listening and you're thinking like, I don't know anyone, well, you've got four potential volunteers or at least I'll volunteer to do that because I think you just need one. And if we don't like each other, I'll find someone who you like better. There's probably more of those people out there than I admit. But the other thing is I think I heard someone say you can't do it all the time. And so my career aspirations shifted pretty radically when I had my daughter, and that the most important thing wasn't me being successful, but it was figuring out how to be a successful mom, if that's even the word, to her. And that's a big thing for someone who happens to be a lawyer who's type A. Not that that resonates with anyone of us, right? Is just how do you personally navigate that is a real thing. And so you may have gone to law school and thought, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z and be immensely successful and try to measure out what that looks like in either a firm that you wanted to work for or a dollar sign for judgment you wanted to get. And so those measures of success, if they haven't shifted, I would say take a step back because it'll show you where the priorities are. And if the priorities are to be for your family and kids and then also work and have a career, that order is really important. And so that balance is what you put in the basket first. So for me, it meant in a very real sense, where you interview, how many hours you're willing to work, you know, and that may adjust the pay. It may adjust the firm. It may adjust, you know, all those things, but those aren't bad. Those are change in expectations. Those aren't failures, but the balance of life, it can't be all of it all the time because you're setting yourself up to fail one or all of those things. And so I know whatever that looks like for each parent, I think that's important sort of to think about because, you know, I think this panel is a great example of that. We all have very different like firm life practice areas and they're all working for us in some regard. And there's always areas to improve, but there's not just one way, but I think the big things are always going to be the big things, which is, you know, it's got to work for you and your family, not just for anybody. And something that I struggle with sometimes is like, well, they did it. You know, I see that she made it through X firm and then is now a judge and is now a this and she's 5 years younger than me. What am I doing? You know, that sort of comparison isn't successful. So that idea that there is an elusive balance out there that somebody has and you don't, it's just a myth. But that balance has got to come in increments and in days and years and kids' ages and activities, you know, and work. It may mean that you don't get to do trial work for a couple of years, but you wait and do it later. Or I don't know what that looks like for each person, but I know for me that it's changed, you know, where I work. It's changed how much I'm willing to work. I joked with my husband this morning, everybody should want to hire a lawyer mom because they're going to get it done. They're not going to overbill. I just don't have time for it. You know, we've got other stuff. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. I love that we all have our own journey. So it's different for everyone. So Carrie, in the interest of time, I'm going to wrap up your last two questions into one. Carrie's going to add some substantive law to this segment because she knows a lot about tax and kids. Carrie, can you give us some quick tips from a tax law perspective for college savings plans and after that, since we already have a lot of work-life balance tips, I was wondering if you could share with the audience how you keep life fun for your family because you do so many fun things with your kids.
Yes. And I will say, I know we're going to skip this, but I will just say very quickly, how do you balance? I put it down in three things. Be picky, be present, be pragmatic. Be picky. Don't say yes to everything that comes across just because it comes across. Say yes to the things that matter, will advance your career, or you really want to do. Be present in your children's lives and be pragmatic. Sometimes you're going to have to burn the midnight oil and you just have to do it. Okay. All right. So now we're done with that. I-29 plans, guys. If you can afford to do so, please start a 529 plan for your child if you don't already have one. So very briefly, some income tax benefits of 529 plans. The nice thing is any amounts you contribute to a 529 plan will grow tax-free. You pay no tax on the gain and you don't have to pay anything when you withdraw so long as you withdraw funds to pay qualified education expenses. What, pray tell, are qualified education expenses? Well, it's kind of the stuff you think about, right? Tuition and fees, books, room and board, supplies and equipment for your classes, for your kids' classes, right? So qualified education expenses, go ahead and withdraw that money after it's grown and your kids are in college. You can pay for all of that. Again, grows income tax free, which is really nice. Now you say, what if I'm going to need to get to this money? What if there is some sort of emergency? Well, never fear, gentle listener. There are ways to get the money back. You would have to pay income tax on the earnings to the extent you make a withdrawal. You have to pay income tax on what has been earned, and you have to pay a 10% penalty. So it is not completely without drawbacks, but you can get the funds if you need it. So you can get them back. Now, one more thing, a gift tax aspect of this. May we all one day, this is my wish for everyone listening, may we all one day have taxable estates. Because right now, if you're married, you've got to have over $24 million to have a taxable estate. So, you know, let's all cross our fingers. For gift tax purposes, you can contribute up to $16,000 per year per person to your 529 plan. Now, this does include gifts, you know, kind of all gifts made to your kids, but the IRS is not tracking the fact that you bought them a bicycle, right? They're not going to say, oh, that was a $200 bicycle, so you can only get $15,800. But you can make gifts of up to $16,000 per person per year. If you have one child and you have a spouse, that is $32,000 you collectively can use to fund a 529 plan every single year. And you can even front load, you can make a contribution equal to up to 5 years of annual exclusion amounts at once. So your annual exclusion is $16,000 right now. You can make a one-time $80,000 contribution to a 529 plan, and you have to file a gift tax return and note that you are making this special 529 plan contribution to elect it. But that's another easy way to go ahead and get funds in the account. So, and then your options, once you have a 529 plan created, keep the funds in the account until they are needed. If you end up with a child who doesn't need as much money as you have socked away and earned in the 529 plan, you can change the beneficiary on it to a younger sibling, to another sibling, to a niece, to a nephew, to anyone you want, right? The money is there. Or you can withdraw it. Now, it's called a non-qualified withdrawal if you don't withdraw it for a qualified education expense, but you can still get the money back. So that is our short little, the more you know. Everyone picture the little star flying across the horizon with a little rainbow behind it, because that is the graphic you would see right now if you were watching and not just listening. Okay, so very briefly, what do you do to keep it fun? Whatever the kids want to do, right? I last year was a soccer coach. I'm a Girl Scout troop leader. I make these dumb signs to embarrass my kids at their soccer games and their basketball games. My daughter's team happened to be in the basketball championship last year, and so I bought poster board, and their team name was the Mercury. So I got 7 pieces of poster board, and everyone had a giant M-E-R spelling it out so that we had like the best signs in the whole arena. And I will tell you, it embarrasses my daughter, but she also secretly likes it. And if I didn't do things like that, she'd be like, well, why isn't she doing things like that? Because I know my daughter well, and she enjoys that. And we just, every now and then I just tell them to get in the car and we go, like, even if we literally just drive to the Bucky's car wash. They love the Bucky's car wash. So we do dumb things like that, you know, and I have this rule that I will nearly always get you a book if you want a book. And so, you know, we get a lot of books and games and things like that. And we bake a lot. I mean, it just, you know, find what your kids are interested in and find a way to be that, you know, extra parent, right? The one that, you know, right on the border of maybe embarrassing your child, but also making them be like, yeah, that's my mom. She's pretty cool, right? I will also say, if those of you who only have one child don't have to worry about this. If you have more than two, you already know this. We're going to say it anyway. Oh my gosh, be as equal as you can, because children do not understand equitable. They only understand equal. So do the best you can.
Amen. The cookie must be cut in half perfectly.
Exactly. That's all I have, Anna.
Thank you so much. I love what we're talking about the fun, because those are the memories we're all trying to make with our children. Even me now that my kids are grown up, I'm still trying to, you know, let them remember the things we do together now, because it doesn't last forever. And so I just want to encourage all the young parents out there to really make those memories just like the three of you have been doing with your children. And thank you so much to each of you for taking your time to impart your advice and for being on Behind the Lines.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Mary Ann, Sarah, and Carrie for being willing to share their experiences with other parent lawyers and legal employers. And now, a wellness break.
I would like to introduce Catherine Krupa, a licensed dietitian and wellness coach with over 20 years of experience who specializes in weight management, sports nutrition, diabetes, GI disorders, endometriosis, heart disease, and pediatric nutrition. Catherine was a dietitian for 3 U.S. Olympic diving teams and worked with 2 gold medalists. Catherine owns a company called Advice for Eating. Welcome to Behind the Lines, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know that you have a lot of lawyer clients, and you're aware that our schedules can be pretty hectic and we tend to eat out a lot. What are your tips for healthy eating when you have to just pick up something to eat?
Sure. And, you know, it's not only my lawyer clients, it's most of us here in Houston. We live a very, you know, hectic life. So when you're going out to eat, the 2 things that generally get you in trouble are portion sizes. So they're a lot larger than what we would eat at home. And then added fat. So things like they add butter onto the meat and the vegetables, or it could be mayonnaise, salad dressing, sauces, those sort of things. So anytime you can take control of those. So it could be splitting your portion in half and then having the other portion the next day for lunch, or it could be getting the salad dressing on the side, getting the mayo on the side, getting the sauce on the side. You can still eat it, but then you have control. So it's ways of you taking control of what's offered to you. I would say in general, the plainer, the better. So, but it doesn't mean you have to eat like a plain chicken breast and broccoli every night either. So, and I would encourage you to try to get vegetables in those meals. A lot of times they're low in vegetables and we in generally are not eating enough vegetables. So.
Great tips. I know that better always makes everything so much better, but I think it's a good idea to just try to not put quite so much on it. So,
yes. So
not only do we eat out all the time, but also as you and all the listeners know, sometimes our jobs can be really stressful. But what do we need to eat more of whenever we're really experiencing times of high stress in our practices?
Well, it's interesting because this is a topic I talk about a lot with all of my clients is stress eating. And when you eat when you're stressed, two main things happen. There are the few people that don't eat very much when they're stressed out, but most of us like to eat. And then we make bad choices because it's comforting or makes us feel better. We look forward to it. And or we don't plan. And so we just eat whatever's available. And in both of those scenarios, you're not feeding yourself the best fuel to deal with this stressful situation. So really, when you're under stress, you want to be eating the best that you can so that you feel as well as you can, your brain's working as well as it can, you know, to deal with the stressful situation. So that's the general, you know, eating healthy advice, right? Fruits and vegetables, which are anti-inflammatory and help with chronic stress and inflammation, and lean proteins and healthy fats. And so, you know, my piece of advice there is it's really hard to do when the Halloween candy is right there to go, oh, let me go eat my yogurt and berries. But being prepared really helps. So having your own healthy snacks, maybe keeping some packs of nuts in your drawer, having fruit around. Because if you don't have the healthy food around, you're always going to default to the unhealthy. And the other part of that, I would say, is staying really well hydrated. So instead of drinking cup after cup after cup of coffee, is staying well hydrated with hydrating fluids, which is mainly water, but also any kind of decaffeinated beverages. Your energy level is always higher when you're hydrated. You feel better. Every system in your body works better because it all requires water. So that's going to help you feel your best.
So when you say healthy fats, do you mean like avocados and nuts?
Avocados, nuts, olive oil, fatty fish like salmon, those sort of things. Hummus is another one of my favorites.
Oh, good. I love hummus. So these are good tips because this episode is going to be coming out right towards the end of holiday season. So everyone's going to be making New Year's resolutions. So
yes,
try to eat more of these foods.
Yes.
So My final question is, this is going to be on the parents-in-law episode. And I was wondering if you could provide a few tips to parents who may have issues with their kids not wanting to eat anything other than, say, from my experience, when I had little kids, chicken nuggets and French fries. So what are your tips for getting kids to actually eat healthy foods?
Yes. So I have, well, he's now 18, but so I have experienced that as well. And I work with many parents and then also kids. And so it's a challenge and we all pick our battles as parents, but you know, the kid is not driving to McDonald's to get the chicken nuggets and fries. That's what's provided. And kids are, in general, unless they have some sort of health issue, are also not going to starve themselves. So I really encourage parents and families to all eat the same thing once, you know, you've kind of moved out of the toddler years, but even as toddlers, making their meals similar to yours, that opens their eyes very quickly. They really want to mimic mom and dad. So they will eat things that are similar to mom and dad, particularly when they're in that kind of 2 to 5 range. As they get older, they may not want to mimic us, but they're still watching us. So we need to have good eating habits. And, you know, if you don't have the things in the house, then they can't eat them. I remember when my son was little, he wanted like Eggo waffles all the time. And that was the only thing he would eat for breakfast. Well, I just quit buying them. And, you know, I think he complained for a day or two and then he had to move on. He had to find something else to eat. And yes, you will have to deal with the temper tantrum here or there. But in the long run, you end up with a healthier eater, a healthier child, a healthier young adult. But I also recommend not to force food because that does not work well. Even if I don't even recommend, you know, you have to eat one bite of this. Our job as parents is to provide a healthy diet for our kids and their job is to eat it. So you want to put some on their plate, but they get to choose what they want to eat. They want to be in control. But you put what's on there and they can eat it or not eat it. And if they don't eat it, you just put Saran wrap over the plate, you put it in the refrigerator. And then when they come and ask for food later, you pull out the plate and then they again have a choice to eat it or not eat it. If they're really hungry, they will eat it. If they're not really hungry, then they won't. So as I mentioned earlier, they in general are not going to starve themselves. We went through this with my son all the time, and it was about 50-50. So 50% of the time, he'd come down and eat the rest of his green beans or whatever it was, and about 50% of the time, he'd go, no, and he would go to bed. So that's not easy at first, but if you can get over the hump and get everybody on the same page, you know, they don't get something else after dinner if they don't eat their dinner. If they get hungry, it's dinner and that's it. It really makes for raising your child in dinner time a lot more peaceful and you end up with a healthier eater.
Makes perfect sense. So basically we're passing our fries habits onto our kids.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, exactly. So thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Lines, Catherine. And for more information for our listeners from Catherine, visit adviceforeating.com.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again, Catherine. Hopefully these tips will help us all keep our resolutions for a healthier 2023.
Our next segment focuses, for lawyers, on practicing while parenting in the teens, tweens, and 20s, and for firms, how to meet the needs of more seasoned lawyer parents. I'd first like to introduce Lewis Thomas. Lewis is a trial lawyer practicing in the areas of criminal defense and plaintiff's personal injury law. Prior to opening Lewis Thomas Law in 2017, he served as a federal and state prosecutor. Lewis is a Baylor Law graduate. In college, he studied government at the University of Texas. Lewis is married to Cherie Thomas, his law partner, and in addition to practicing law together, they are raising 3 bright daughters, ages 15, 12, and 8. His daughters keep him young, and sometimes they even laugh at his dad jokes. In his spare time, Lewis enjoys coaching his daughter's softball and basketball teams, running 10Ks, and being outside as much as possible. Thanks for joining us on Behind the Lines, Lewis.
Thanks, Anna. Glad to be here.
Our other guest is Rachel Thompson. Rachel is an associate at Winston & Strawn LLP. She focuses on complex commercial litigation, energy and environmental matters, and international arbitration. Rachel has a BA and an MA in English and she earned her JD from the University of Houston Law Center in 2019. She clerked for Judge Ewing Werlein Jr. in the Southern District of Texas prior to joining Winston & Strawn. Rachel has two boys aged 17 and 20. She is enjoying watching her youngest son in his last year of playing basketball as a senior in high school and is looking forward to traveling to Paris in the spring to visit her oldest, who will be studying abroad in France. Thanks, Rachel, for joining us today.
Oh, glad to be here.
Additionally, I might be chiming in on these topics a little bit more than usual because in addition to hosting this podcast and many other things, I am the mom of three amazing and talented kids aged 22, 23, and 27. So let's get started. Our main topic is practicing law while parenting. You are each in different parenting stages and started being parents at different stages in your careers. I'd like to briefly talk to each of you about specific aspects of practicing while parenting, and I'll start with Rachel. So Rachel, you and I have something major in common, and that is that we both went to law school while parenting. How old were your kids when you went to law school, and did their ages play any part in your decision to go to law school, and how did that go?
Well, I like to say that my elevator pitch is my oldest went to high school, my youngest went to middle school, and I went to law school. So their ages definitely played a role in my deciding to go to law school. I had one child who was starting high school, and I had been through the middle school process with him. I had been through elementary school. At the time, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I had done all the PTA, room mom, all of that good stuff. And my kids were getting older, and I knew I wanted to get back into the workforce, and I wanted to do something interesting as a career for the latter part of my life. So I just got this crazy idea to go to law school. And I talked to my husband about it. And he's like, yeah, you should do it. And we figured the best time would be around that time, once they were out of elementary school, because the kids needed, you know, less attention. They're more independent. And we could also help them out in life by making them more independent. Like when I went to law school, my kids started doing their own laundry. It was great. Just along those lines, we figured that was a good time because, again, it was just they didn't need help doing their homework. And I could go to school during the day while they were in school and come home and have a little bit of family time and then get on to doing my homework.
So did you do homework together with the kids?
I did not. I went in my office and did the homework. Usually after they went to bed or, you know, when they were winding down, I would get home from law school, you know, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock and still had time to get dinner ready and then spend time with my family. And then about 8 o'clock, I would go back to work. And I would usually do my homework then from 8 until when I went to bed. And that was kind of the schedule that worked well for me while I was in law school. You know, different people have different ways of studying. But for me, late at night in the evenings was my go-to time.
I know I went to bed many times with a highlighter in my hand. Yes.
And, you know, and I spent many hours sitting in a car at a band competition or at Little League practice, you know, with a casebook on my lap and a highlighter. And, you know, between innings, let's get a page read here or something like that.
So do you have any advice for students who are trying to remain active parents while they're also attending law school?
Well, just like I said, I would try to schedule time with my family and do my homework around those family times. So dinner was important. We had dinner together every night, and then I would do my homework. And part of it as well, I wasn't able to maybe get involved in all the activities I would have liked. Like I did not do moot court or mock trial because of the practices and the extra time that it required to be on campus. I was able to do law review because I could do that on my own time. So I could do that on the weekends or again during my studying time. So that was one, I don't want to say sacrifice, but like a concession I made and a compromise I had to make during my law school time so that I could have family time. Usually too, on Fridays, I would carve out Friday nights for family time, whether it be going to the football game or whatever we had going on, going to dinner with my family, so that we always had certain times when we would spend time together. Saturday afternoons, I usually studied. Sunday afternoons, I usually studied. So I tried to make sure I had specific family times, but then also, you know, make sure I had enough time to get the studying done.
I think that's great advice. I know when when I went to law school, my kids were younger than yours, but I always thought it was a good idea to give them that example that we thought education right. was so important. And I imagine specifically at the ages your kids were, that really did right. drive it home for them, seeing you work so hard that they also needed to work hard.
Exactly. There's no excuse when mom's studying. You know, if you want to, if you get a bad grade or something, I could look at him and say, hey, you see the time I put in, you know.
Exactly. So was there anything about how your law school supported you as a parent, or anything you wish your law school had done to support you as a parent, that would have made it easier for you to kind of maintain an active family life?
Well, I don't know about how your experience was at University of Houston, but for me personally, I thought it was great. And I thought they had a lot of support. But I think it comes down to talking to people and letting them know that you need that support. There was a time when my parents had some health issues. And I was traveling back to Pennsylvania where my family is. You know, with older kids and parents, you're kind of in that sandwich generation. So I was doing both, you know, while in law school. And there was a time where it was stressful. And I went and talked to the deans there. And I said, look, this is what I've got going on. And they helped me out with some credit issues and were just willing to listen. But again, it takes communication. Like, you have to go and support yourself. You have to be your own best advocate, so to speak. And so I think if you know you need that help and you need a little support, making it known, you know, don't try to do it all on your own and not communicate those needs. So that was important to me, was to let them know what I needed if I ever needed a little extra help. And I did find that the university was very supportive when the time came that I did need that.
I mean, the same can be said now as an associate at a firm or any kind of career mm-hmm. you have. It's the best way to handle these things is just to let people know, because everyone has these things right. in their lives. I mean, it might not have to do with kids, who knows, but there are times whenever you need extra support or you might have a good reason you need to take off, and communicating is key, I think, in every situation.
Yes, it is. And you're right. It transfers over to the law firm environment as well. And again, it's just communicating with your team, communicating with those more senior than you, more junior with you, whenever something arises. And people are always happy to accommodate. But if they don't know you need it, then they can't help.
Great. So, Lewis, we're going to get to you in just a minute, unless you have something to add on what we're talking to Rachel about, just chime in. But I wanted to ask Rachel about, now that she's entered a new stage of parenting, specifically the college application and college stage. You have one child applying right now, one who's already applied and is in college, and you're going to be an empty nester soon, which I know something about. So how's all of that going? Do you have any tips for parents who are entering these phases of parenting?
Well, number one is enjoy the time that you have. So my son's a senior. He plays basketball, and I am doing everything in my power to make it to all of his games this year. It's the last year. This is it. So that's number one, is just enjoy the time you have and make sure you schedule out that time, because this year is going to go fast. For the college application, it's like everything else. Plan ahead. I have two boys, and they are not proactive. So it takes a lot of parental involvement, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of, are you done? Have you done this? Are you done?
I have been there.
It is what it is. I love them. They're great, but it just takes some time. So we planned out the essay over the summer. Like, my son wrote his essay over the summer, and, you know, it might have been difficult sometimes, but we had to get it done so we could get those applications in. And you can actually outsource some of this help. We have worked with a college consulting company, and I know that's not for everybody, but when you don't have a lot of time and you need some help, it was worthwhile for us. And she helped us find tutors for SAT. She helped us with the essay. She helped my son look at his skill set to kind of narrow his choices down in colleges. Some of the stuff that I didn't have time for, whereas if I weren't working full-time as an attorney, I might have had time to help him with. And I have mom friends who do all this on their own. But knowing that my husband and I just did not have the time on some of these tasks to help, we found somebody to help us. And that worked out really well. And now we're just in the waiting game. You know, the applications are in, thankfully. So we're just waiting to find out.
You're a little early on that, aren't you?
Yeah, it's so early now. I know. Like, I remember when I went to college, you had to get them in by April or something crazy. I mean, my son wants to go to A&M, so that's rolling. So he wanted to get that in right away. And it's just, yeah, I guess you could get it in a little bit later, but again, we just wanted to get them in and get it done. It can be a full-time job for a parent if you let it. And, you know, we couldn't do that right now. So we just had to, you know, take it in chunks and get it done. I'll be glad when that's done. And I, you know, talking about empty nester, I'm looking forward to it. I love my kids. I'm just looking forward to a new chapter in life. And, you know, maybe that sounds too strong. My kids might listen to this.
Trust me, your kids are not going to listen to
this. They aren't going to listen to this, I know. Though I am looking forward to being an empty nester. My husband and I are going to downsize. We live in Clear Lake. We're looking forward to maybe getting a place in town closer to work, which would be nice. So
definitely. Well, now you just have to keep your fingers crossed that there is no world pandemic that brings all of your kids back home after, right, the same year that you became an empty nester, because that is exactly what happened to me. So right. We were an empty nesters for one semester. And then the next spring, we had three grown-up kids living with us, all sharing the internet. So that was fun.
My son, my oldest, started during the pandemic. And let me tell you, it's not a great time. I guess your youngest did. As well, as you know, terrible time to start college, but it all worked out.
Yeah, though it made him stronger. So that's good. I'm going to switch gears. Lewis, your situation's a little different. So you have school-age kids, and lately you and your entire family have been so busy because your lovely wife has been running for office. I mean, I think I'm busy right now because it's the holiday season, but that schedule was just intense. Plus that you run your own law firm on top of that. So how did you manage to fit in family time with so much going on? And what suggestions do you have for other lawyers who have maybe a smaller practice that they're running and they're also trying to maintain a healthy family life?
First off, my oldest daughter is really good at cooking macaroni and cheese and broccoli. So there's a lot of that was eaten in our house over the last several months. But no, Sheree and I think we work together well because she does her stuff and I do my stuff and we meet for dinner. And that's really kind of our thing, is like you talked about planning a family time. So her stuff was always in the evening for campaign. I'm a like morning person. So I had great energy in the morning, and then dinner was kind of the overlap that we could normally make where we can wrangle the kids and have that time. And then she's off to whatever evening event that whichever county needed her to be at. So it was a challenge for sure. But, you know, the kids were excited for mom to be, you know, running for judge. So I think they were supportive, and I know Sheree got buy-in from them.
It's kind of the same, like what we were talking about with going to school and being that example for your kids. Your wife was an example for the kids on, if you want to do something, run for office. And I think that's a really cool example.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they saw that, you know, she had a goal and they wanted mom to succeed and they wanted to help her succeed. And I mean, fortunately, like our youngest is 8. So, I mean, we're to that point where kids can tie their shoes and, you know, brush their teeth and that kind of good stuff. So they become a lot more self-sufficient, I think, over the last year. But I, you know, it's communication, I think, is key. And as like Rachel talked about, like, you know, just making sure everybody else is aware of what's going on with the kids at the time. And we have a, you know, chalkboard up in the house and we talk about calendars all the time. And thank goodness for text messages nowadays. I mean, I don't know how we could have done this 10 years ago when we started, or before we had kids. But yeah, it's just, we're, you know, you get really good at carpools and moving around and asking people for help. Sometimes kids would be at other places for a little while and that kind of thing. But fortunately for us, like having your own law practice has been flexible. I mean, I spent a lot of my for like almost 10 years working for the government, and they are less flexible. So I realized that if we're going to have 3 kids and want to do some things like, you know, coach softball and run for office, those kind of things, like you got to be able to be flexible. So I feel fortunate that, you know, I've been able to manage trial schedule and also, you know, take care of the girls and help them with activities. Only one time last spring, I'm really proud of myself. I only had to run out on the softball field in my work clothes one time. So most of the time it will work, but you just, you know, you lean on folks for help sometimes. But yeah, it's been challenging, but I really, like I said, having your own firm, I think you can't beat the schedule. So that's the reason to do it.
That's great. I'm just amazed at how much you do in their kids' lives on top of your already crazy schedule with the campaign and your own firm. So that's incredible. But it sounds like organization and kind of having a village to help out whenever needed. So that's wonderful. So we're going to move on to legal issues associated with having teens, tweens, and kids in their 20s. And what I want to talk about now is bullying, and particularly cyberbullying. It's a huge issue that parents face with children in these age groups. And I think, in fact, that Texas has a relatively new anti-cyberbullying statute. And most schools, of course, have policies in place about cyberbullying. So do either of you have tips for lawyer parents on talking to their kids about bullying and cyberbullying? And let's start with Lewis.
You know, I have been real open with my oldest is 15. And so she's the one who I think is most interested in the world of the internet. And so as a prosecutor for a long time, I don't know so much as a lawyer generally, but especially as a prosecutor, I feel like I'm hyper vigilant about the perils of what's gone on out there in the world. I would say my oldest is like, she wants to know, Daddy, what do you do? Daddy, what do you do? Daddy, what do you do? And for a long time, I tried to like shield her from the fact that I handled, you know, criminal cases. And so I'm like, you know, just go, you know, be a doctor, go do something else. But I think, you know, I've explained to her, you know, I think in a not just a fear-mongering way, but in a realistic way that, you know, everybody out there on the internet's not there to be your friend. And everything that you do on the internet is permanent. So I feel I've tried to give her sanitized examples of that in a, you know, age appropriate way. I'm not trying to freak out my kids, but I do want to let them know, like anytime there's, you know, those games that where you can chat with anonymous people, those are fraught with peril. And there's always people on the other side of that that are looking to, you know, do less than good. So I think that they have a healthy understanding of that. I don't know so much about my youngest wants to be a YouTuber and YouTube star. So I'm not sure that we've hit the home run yet with her, but the older girls, I think, kind of understand where the boundaries ought to be. And they know one of the things that I've seen other parents do that makes me pause is they don't feel like their kids' internet use is something they can always monitor. And I feel like I've told my kids from jump, like you, whatever you see, we're going to see. And that's just been understood since, you know, beginning of the iPad. So I think that's really important to establish that communication right at the beginning.
That's pretty scary what can happen out there. So, and also, you know, I was a Girl Scout leader and they had a whole curriculum around cyberbullying specifically and bullying at school. So we taught the girls all about it from a pretty young age. I think the curriculum's for middle school Girl Scouts. So yeah. Rachel, do you have anything to add on this topic?
I'll just reiterate what Lewis said about, you know, knowing what your kids are looking at. We've had the same rule. I mean, the phones that they have are the phones that we pay for. So, you know, at any time I might look at it, and I always knew their passwords and they knew I knew their passwords. And they knew that sometimes I would look at it, didn't always look at it, but that opportunity might happen sometimes. And then if there was something there, there's been times where I'd say, hey, what is this on your phone? And they're like, oh, you know, but that's part of being a parent. We look at it and we monitor it. And I think that's very important in today's world, to know what your kids are looking at, to know what they're doing with this massive amount of technology they hold in their hands every day.
So, is the same true for like the reverse of that, as far as making sure that your kids don't get in trouble maybe for bullying someone on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I'll be honest with you. I think the most important, I mean, to me, the main thing you can do as a parent is to encourage your kid to find other kids who are not involved in that. So I don't know how you know, obviously your kids do things that you don't always know about right away, but I don't think any of my kids would be cyber bullies. And I think they can understand why that's a bad thing. I don't know how everybody's kids are. My kids are very mindful of like words hurt and words matter, more so than me as a, you know, even as a dad, but especially as a young person growing up. Permanence of words, I don't think was such a important point as a kid, in my, at least from my experience, as they are now.
It's different now because we have the internet. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I just, you know, I can't tell you that like I real time monitor. I mean, I know there's apps out there that do that, but one of my daughters, like she's in a chat group with one of her, you know, I call them nerd friends, but anyway, they're a little art group. Basically, they talk about drawing and I don't want to talk about drawing all the time. So, you know, I feel comfortable that they're not bullying each other just because I know, okay, these are the kids that are in art class. And so they're being reasonable to each other. But yeah, I mean, I think just know who your kids, you know, I just ask my kids annoying questions. And that's why, you know, the dad jokes part I made at the front, you know, like they do, you know, give me grief about it sometimes, but I don't mind asking questions and getting grief, especially, I mean, as a lawyer, you ought to be used to asking questions and getting grief. So I don't mind getting it from my kids.
That's good. Do you have anything else on that, Rachel?
I was just going to say, yeah, we reiterate to our kids that, you know, like my husband and I will say when we were young, if we did things that were stupid or whatever, it didn't last past, you know, a day or two. Now, anything that's done is there forever. So we just try to let them know, just, you know, you have to be careful and you just need to be more cognizant these days than you used to have to be in the past.
One point before we move on the topic of my kids, like I know what they're doing. My son went to an entire prom whenever he was a junior in high school, and we never knew until after he was grown up. So it's just like, why did he not tell us? I don't know, but he didn't want us to get all like in his business or something. So it's just, you're going to learn things as they get older that you did not actually know. So it's funny. So, Lewis, since you do a lot of criminal defense work, I was wondering if you could share what advice, and your oldest daughter is 15, so this is going to be happening soon if it hasn't already. What advice are you going to give her when she gets her driver's license for if she's stopped by law enforcement?
Well, that's a good one. I, you know, tell my clients that they have a right to remain silent and they should exercise it, but also I would say more for a teenage driver, I'm going to teach her to be prudent and cooperative. I, you know, even though I'm a defense attorney and I have been for 6 or so years now, I do have a healthy respect for law enforcement and I have tried to share that with my kids. So I would say in the most of the occasions, they're trying to do the right thing and they are just trying to make sure that you're not a bad guy. So everything she can do to dispel that in a quick and professional way, I think she should do it. She should be direct. She should not over explain and be courteous, but not offer too much. And so I think that's good advice. I mean, I think where law enforcement encounters with young people go awry is when they're discourteous because law enforcement don't want that encounter and they're not good at de-escalating that. And so I think, you know, as a young person, your job is to be respectful and treat them like a teacher, I think would be the right encounter or right attitude about it. But, you know, I don't think that they should at the same time tolerate misconduct. And I think my kids, you know, especially like I said, having girls, they're real sensitive to personal space and touch. And so, you know, I think in a healthy way. And so I don't think they should tolerate police misconduct either. And so, you know, I think they know the line, like the questions that are professional and then the area where things are not going professional. And that's, you know, where they could reasonably reach out for help. And I think my girls, you know, you try to hope that your kids have good judgment and know where those lines are. But yeah, I would say start with treating them as a professional. And then I think you'll be, in most cases, you're going to be okay.
So what about if the police ask them to search their car? Because this actually happened to my son.
Yeah, I've been, you know, as a young person, I was subject to a police search way out in West Texas. I think I was 19 and it was very uncomfortable and unpleasant. And I was coming from Big Bend. So we were coming from the border. And so I've been there and I remember what it felt like. And I have other close family members that have been there too and know what it felt like. And so you as a person have an absolute right not to consent. And so there is no reason for you to give consent. If the police need to find a reason, they have the tools and the ability to get that search done if they decide that's what they want to do. So I don't think in the ordinary case, there's any reason to give consent. You can ask reasonably to have a chance to talk to counsel. That's not an unreasonable request, especially in the day of cell phones. The police officer can let you pick up a phone. It won't make you look guilty. It will make you look reasonable and you're exercising your right. So I would say respectfully refuse, sir or ma'am. But I would like to talk to an attorney before I consented to any search. And I think that would be a reasonable thing to teach a teenage driver and keep them out of trouble and also exercise the rights that they do have.
Especially a teenage driver who can call their parent who is a lawyer. So.
Right. Yeah,
I'm going to teach my kids that.
Yeah. I just, you know, I remember feeling harassed and, you know, my parents are good parents and they're accountants. And so this really just didn't, you know, the point was don't get in trouble. And I think that's good advice, but sometimes stuff happens and you're in the right spot. And honestly, you are in the wrong. And I'll say this as a defense attorney, I'm amazed at how many times people are in places that they normally are not and things happen that they don't expect. So it really does. The world is not always predictable. And so I think, but you do have those rights, whether you're in a spot you want to be in or not. You know, if you're coming home from Whataburger with a friend you don't really know, or you take somebody home from an event that you don't really know as well, you don't need to give consent. You just need to be respectful about it and exercise those rights.
I think mainly it's important for parents to kind of think about these things when their kids are starting to get to this age and they're going to be going and doing things on their own and not have us right by their sides, to have those tough conversations with them when it happens. Because like you said, you really don't know if they might. You may think my kid's never going to get stopped by a police officer and I'm asked to search the car. I mean, my son told me this. He was kind of in the same situation you were in. I was like, what? They asked to search your car? That's never happened to me before. But I guess that, you know, when they're kids that age, they just maybe suspect that they have drugs or something. I don't know. But thankfully, he didn't have anything. He did consent to having his car searched, though. So there you go. So talk to your kids about it beforehand. So before we go, since you all are more experienced parents, do you have any parting advice for either parents who have younger children or for law firms who are trying to retain healthy and happy parent lawyers?
I'll just say something that I learned, and I've never worked at a big firm, so I don't know. Well, my wife has, and I know it was as a government lawyer working with a firm lawyer wife, I know it was tough for us at first, especially when we had little kids. So we managed it. I think one thing I learned as a dad along the way, and I will tell you, you're not doing nearly as much as you think you are. And so I learned that probably after the kids were, you know, way out of diapers and all that good stuff. So I think just kind of check yourself sometimes about, you know, everybody, and I tell my kids this too, like everybody thinks that what they're doing is the most important. You know, she had an important career, has an important career. I feel like I had and have whatever an important career, but really my kids are, that's going to be the most important thing that I ever do. And I know that like in my life. So once that sort of realization came in, all the other things kind of fall into place after that. I mean, you want to keep your boss happy and keep your job and keep your insurance. But, you know, I realized that I didn't do as good of a job listening, especially when the kids were little. So I guess my kids are middle age or whatever now, like they're almost, you know, getting ready to get out, but they're not out yet. And so just be open to communication. Like if things are getting upset, maybe sometimes it's a cry for a little bit more help in a specific area from your partner or whatever. And just be open to that. And I think that would have been something that I wish I had heard from an older lawyer whenever I had little kids. So I'll just leave it there.
I love it. Kind of try to put yourself in your spouse's shoe and realize they're also dealing with stuff. So that's wonderful. What about you, Rachel? Any parting words?
Yeah, I mean, I'm at a big firm now and, you know, I'm coming at it differently than most of my colleagues who are at the same level as me. So most, you know, I'm working with people much my junior and, you know, they're just having babies or they're just getting married. And so I'm finding it interesting just having those relationships with my peers in my career and being able to give them, you know, some parenting tips or just trying to be a mentor in that regard and saying, it's okay if this happens, or let me know if you have any questions about what's going on. So I try to to myself just be a resource to people I work with in, you know, who are parenting the much younger children. I do think it's important to find a firm that provides or a job that provides support. I know we've got a pretty good maternity and paternity leave for attorneys and, you know, many months. So that's really helpful. Right now, I'm working with two fabulous women who just came back from maternity leave, one after having her first, one after having her second. And I'm just amazed at what they can do and how they do this big law job with these little babies and, you know, how they manage it all. And I think they rely on support, you know, from family, they rely on their husbands, they get help when they need it. And again, it's finding a place where, you know, the partners and the senior associates you work with know what your family situation is and are, you know, open to when your kid has a problem, go take care of it. And I feel like I have that support here and I'm thankful for it. And so I, you know, you just, again, I go back to what I said earlier, you just need to communicate your needs and, you know, let people know if there's a problem or if you're having a struggle so that they can help you out.
Really, it's so true. The people that you're working under right now also are people. You know, they have families, they may not have kids, but they've had parents or they have siblings. And usually most will understand if you just communicate with them. So that's wonderful advice. So thank you, both of you. I really enjoyed talking with you this evening. And thanks for joining us behind the lines.
Thanks so much, Anna.
I hope you were all as inspired by Rachel and Lewis as I was. Maybe we can add dinner time with the family to our list of resolutions.
This short segment is about international adoption. Our guest is Heather Potts. Heather is an associate at Nathan Summers Jacobs. She represents trustees, creditors, and debtors in the bankruptcy courts and has prosecuted and defended bankruptcy appeals. Heather also represents parties in business disputes and arbitrations. Heather is a former English teacher who taught high school in rural El Paso. She then went on to earn her law degree at Baylor Law School. Away from the office, Heather is the adoptive parent of two teenaged boys. Welcome to Behind the Lines, Heather.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So first, I want to talk about your experience with adopting children while practicing law. Did you adopt both of your children when you were practicing?
I did. I started the practice of law in 2006 and didn't initiate the first adoption of my son Trezor until 2014. So I had many years practicing without children, and that's its own, you know, its own thing. And certainly circumstances changed when I became a parent and balancing all of the, you know, lots of things with the practice of law.
Yeah, it seems like for a lot of people, your priorities just have to readjust a little bit whenever you become a parent. So can you talk about how you handled that with your law firm as far as adopting children whenever you were practicing law? And if you have any advice for law practice managers when it comes to supporting lawyers who adopt?
Sure. Well, you know, even though I feel like sometimes I haven't been a lawyer that long, I feel like things have changed a great deal from when I began my practice to now. I feel like firms are a lot more eager to work with parents, not just mothers, but parents who are, you know, working to best support their families. I've been fortunate that I've had two different law firms, one law firm with my first son, who I adopted, Trezor, in 2016. And then just a recent adoption that was accomplished just a couple of months ago, two different law firms, but both very supportive, both provided paid leave. I do not, you know, I know there's FMLA. I'm not an expert in that area of law, so I don't know. I know there's a requirement in terms of the number of people that are employees that need to be with a firm before a firm is required to do that. But I would encourage law firm managers, HR professionals, just to understand that really great lawyers also want to be great parents and great family members and have full lives. And sometimes that means that they step away for a little bit, or they need a little extra support or a little bit of different support. Not that they're not able to do the work, but they need a different context in which to do that work. I have, like I said, I've been fortunate that I've had two firms who have supported me in that, and am right in the middle of it right now. And I've had a couple people call me in the last couple of days and have been very apologetic to have to chat with me about a few questions on cases, but just knowing that they want me to be able to do what I need to do to make our adoption successful has been very encouraging and has made me eager to meet their needs also. And so I think that's just human nature. If you know that your organization is ready to support you, you want to support them as well.
Yeah, I guess basically just letting you know that they care and that they see, you know, what you're doing is important to you, and they want you to be fulfilled in every way, not just as a lawyer. So did you find any differences with the fact that you adopted older children versus babies? Because I'm guessing that some firms may like look at that differently, but still you're adding a new family member. Even if it's not an infant that needs your care, it's still a child and a human being who needs you. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, and I'll just take this opportunity to tell anyone who's involved in HR or anyone who's involved in law firm management that while my body did not, no baby came out of my body. No. And do I need physical respite in terms of that? No. But adoption is really hard work. And especially there's never a version of adoption that doesn't involve trauma. And that can manifest itself in so many different ways. And I think for an adoptive parent, just like for a parent who's having a biological child, you don't know what's ahead of you. And you don't know if once you have your baby or once you meet your child, if there are new things that are going to show up that you were not aware of or other people were not aware of, your doctors, caregivers of your adoptive child that show up. I mean, I just in our own little situation here, we've had a little hiccup. And I say a little hiccup, meaning it's a big hiccup, but you know, I wasn't prepared for that. And I couldn't have been prepared for that because I didn't know it was going to happen. And it's not anything big, but it's something that's going to take some time to work through. And so it's been meaningful to have the support of my firm and not thinking that, well, you're back from your trip and you finalized your adoption and he's a citizen now and you have your documents from the U.S. Embassy, so you can come on back in. No, there's lots of things that, you know, there's lots of doctor's appointments. There's some therapist appointments that need to start getting set up. There are just time I need to spend to establish a connection with my son that just need to happen. And I'm thankful that my firm has let me be the expert on adoption and hasn't tried to tell me what I need and what I don't need. Because I'm the one who's done all the research and I'm the one who's done an adoption before. And so I know what issues are likely to occur and what unknowns are out there that I can't anticipate, except maybe 24 hours before.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's like, it's going to be an adjustment no matter what. I'm sure also for your other son, it's just a new member to your family and not a baby that's like coming up and you're molding, but really somebody who already has an established personality and y'all are all trying to figure out how to live with each other. So thank you for what you do. I think it's great that you have adopted older children. And as far as the FMLA and what it requires, thankfully, we do have an article in the upcoming issue of the Houston Lawyer that is going to outline those requirements. So no need for an FMLA specialist here. I was mostly interested in like what firms need to think about beyond that. So I appreciate your input on that. Did you want to say anything else on it?
Well, and just to reiterate, I hope that firms are more interested in meeting the needs of their attorneys and their employees more than just, you know, meeting the standards that are, you know, out there legally. Yes, of course, here's what you have to do by law and here's what you don't have to do by law. But do you want to keep good people? Or even do you just want to help develop better employees, better lawyers? Do you see potential? And if you can meet their needs and help them feel secure and supported as a mother or a father or just a family member who's trying to care for other people in their family. I mean, I think that's how you create just a better environment at your firm. And I know it's different based on numbers that you have at a firm, but I'm at a, you know, relatively small firm so that all the lawyers know each other. We're on the same floor. So that's nice. And everybody has been very encouraging. So it would stand out in a way if someone wasn't, was like, oh, there she goes again. trying to have a baby. That would not be helpful for my motivation. I want my firm to succeed. And part of that is because I feel like they've been very supportive in how I build my family and how I build the other part of my life, which helps me be a better lawyer.
I mean, that's huge, right? Like if you want your employees to want to support your mission, then support them in the way they need and make them feel valued. And this is one way that as a firm or a manager of any kind of employer, you can do that.
It hasn't been perfect. There have been some issues, but the one thing that was important to me is that when there have been mistakes made, that people have come back and said, you know what, I misspoke, or let me rephrase what I said. So that's important too. I hope people don't feel like they have to get it right the first time. Just try and educate yourself. And that's applicable in so many areas of life, right? In so many
areas
that we don't, that we're not our own experts. So the same goes.
And just getting along with people in general, whether it's work or outside of work. So,
Exactly. Yeah. So
you talked a little bit about that you had gone away internationally to adopt both of your sons, right?
Yes, they're both from the same country.
So are there any legal issues or obstacles that lawyers who want to adopt internationally should be looking out for that you can kind of talk about given your experience?
Well, it's interesting. I always live and die by the theory that if you overprepare, you can beat most people who are smarter than you. at least like 75% of those people, right? And so we had some issues with our last adoption that I did not overprepare for, and it wasn't all my fault, but some of it was my fault, but some of it was just other individuals, and it created so much drama. And I had to visit the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi so many more times than I wanted to. So often that the guards were like welcoming me back repeatedly and saying, oh, it's so nice to see you again. And I'm like, you're lovely, but I don't want to see you anymore. And my last visit, I said, I told a couple of them, I feel like we should have a group picture, and they laughed, but they're like, we're not allowed to do that. And I was like, I know you're not allowed to do that, but I was just trying to be sarcastic. So I would say that, yes, there are certain traits that you develop as a lawyer, or maybe that you had inherently that led you to the practice of law, that will serve you in the process both of international and domestic adoption. But there are very different processes and different people. And, you know, even just walking up to the window at the embassy, I guess it was helpful in understanding the concept of leverage in negotiations. I had no leverage. And so I just had to be super nice and be very sweet and very polite. And I don't always have to do that. But it was good to understand that, no, you just have to say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And I will do that. And I will come back as soon as I can with those other documents that you have requested, because there was nothing else I could do. But everything is so different in different countries. So no, you're not going to have a big head start just being a lawyer. But, you know, the idea of having good attention to detail and following deadlines or meeting deadlines and understanding also that certain things are out of your control once it's with the court, you know, and especially in a court outside of the US, there's nothing you can do to motivate a judge to sign a decree. I mean, I guess you could try some things, but I wouldn't encourage that. So, you know, just learning to be patient, and that's something we have to do as lawyers, but also I think that happens in a variety of contexts. It's not just a legal skill, right?
Right. So it sounds like cross your T's, dot your I's, and mind your manners will get you a long way, and being patient.
Yes. Yes. Now, did I mind my manners in the airport coming back? No. So I was probably...
I'm sure you were just exhausted.
I was so tired at that point. Yeah. No. So it was just, it was difficult, but we made it. We got back here.
Congratulations again. So we're about to wrap up, but do you have any parting tips for people who want to adopt, maybe just for older children, not necessarily international or local, but in general, if you're bringing an older child into your home?
I have like two different things. First is, and this isn't just necessarily related to older kids, but something I learned once I became a mother, because I became a mother as a single person. And I used to, part of the way I was a really good lawyer is I got to stay at the office till like 9 p.m. at night, every night. And I didn't get to do that when I became a mother. And so I had to work on that and adjust some habits, but also realized after talking with some friends and some health professionals that I had ADD. And so I would encourage people who become parents and find it really difficult to parent and practice law to talk to people and talk to other lawyers and talk to your doctors, or, you know, explore that and find out if there is something that you were previously successful at because you were just, you were there all day, every day. And that's what I had lots of coping mechanisms that I didn't get to have once I was a parent. So that's one thing I would encourage people to do. And I had lots of people in my life who did that for me. So it's important for me to share that with others. And, you know, I think it's important to reduce the stigma of seeking care for mental health issues. And just specifically as women in our late 30s and early 40s and late 40s, there are all kinds of studies that show that we don't get diagnosed until we are at that age, because we have figured out how to make it work. And then something hits, like you adopt a child or you become a mother, and they're like, holy crap, you know, this isn't working. So that's one thing I would say. As to older child adoption. So before I was a lawyer, I was a high school teacher. I love teenagers. I think they're the best people in the world. They're the funniest. They are the most honest. They will just, I mean, it can be really, it can be difficult, but I love it. And when I first started pursuing adoption, I talked to I have two older sisters, and the older of my two sisters is also an adoptive parent. And she adopted her children through domestic foster care. And I was talking to her and I said, well, I think I'll try to pursue adoption of an infant. And she basically she's like, why would you do that? And we talked about it, and I'm just so happy that she helped me see that that's not what has to be the way everybody forms their family. You don't have to start with a baby. I am very thankful, because I would have missed out on my two boys if that had been really important to me. And so I'm thankful that my sister spoke that truth into my life. And so I adopted Resort when he was 6, almost 7. And I adopted Clovis when he is 14. 14 is harder than 7, but we're going to get it done. So, and I'm excited to be on this journey with my boys.
I'm so happy that y'all found each other. It's just wonderful to see that. And thank you so much for sharing about your diagnosis with ADD, because I think that that is really important for people to be willing to share. And I know several lawyers that do deal with ADD. I think it's probably more prominent than we realize. So, and it can impact so many things. So thank you so much for sharing your story about you and your boys. And congratulations again on your newest addition to your family. And thank you for joining us on Behind the Lines.
Okay, thanks.
I'd now like to introduce Mark Yablon, a Behind the Lines interviewer who is also a Houston-based attorney with a statewide practice in commercial litigation, bankruptcy, real estate, and probate.
Good morning, Judge Simoneau. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing, Mr. Yablon?
Doing very well, thank you. So Behind the Lines wanted to interview you regarding your leading efforts to bring best practices to the guardianship process and your efforts to promote pro bono work through various professional organizations such as Houston Young Lawyers Association and the Houston Volunteer Lawyers Guardianship Partnership. So just for the listener's background on you very briefly, I want to let everyone know that Judge Simoneau presides over the Harris County Probate Court 1 and was just reelected a few weeks ago. So congratulations on your victory.
Thank you.
You're welcome. In private practice for 21 years, Judge Simoneau concentrated on estate planning and probate litigation and appeals. You also were a staff attorney for your current court, a former judge at the Houston Municipal Courts, and a former adjunct professor at South Texas College of Law. Correct?
You've done your homework, yes.
Well, in the internet age, it's quite easy. When not holding court, you are a frequent speaker at continuing education seminars teaching other judges about probate law. This year, you were selected by the National Center for State Courts as one of only 5 national delegates to participate in the 4th National Guardianship Summit, which occurs just once a decade. So welcome to the show, and let's learn more about your guardianship efforts.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Judge, can you tell us about the day in the life of a Harris County probate judge?
Wow. That is a question that would take me half the program to explain. But basically, we have about 60 to 70 uncontested hearings each week on probate of wills. We have probably about 6 or so guardianship uncontested hearings, and then we have contested matters that we take up. So it's an extraordinarily busy court. I have 12 staff members, and it takes every single one of them every minute of their day to help me get through the week. It's a big job.
Sounds like it. When and why did you decide to become involved with Houston Young Lawyers Association and the Houston Volunteer Lawyers regarding the guardianship matters?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, my involvement with the Houston Volunteer Lawyers goes all the way back to when I was a brand new attorney. I was a volunteer there. Back then it was called Houston Volunteer Lawyers Program. And so I still call it HVLP, although the P is no longer there. And then once I got involved in probate and particularly guardianships, I became a mentor through HVL for other attorneys who may be practicing in the area of guardianship or probate of wills who had no experience doing it. And I thoroughly enjoyed that as well, because even as a mentor, you learn, you get situations you've never seen before, and you learn too.
Right.
So that's how I got started. And then after I was elected the first time in 2018, the Houston Volunteer Lawyers approached me. Their judicial director, Judge Daryl Moore, was no longer on the bench. And they asked if I would fill his very big shoes, both literally and figuratively, because he's a very tall man. But he was also extraordinary. He was so good at what he did with the Houston Volunteer Lawyers. And of course, I've always enjoyed the Houston Volunteer Lawyers, and I was delighted to have an opportunity to serve in some way. And so that's how I got involved as a director in Houston Volunteer Lawyers.
All right, great. And what are a couple of reforms briefly that you are trying to implement or have implemented in the guardianship?
Yeah, I don't know about reforms, but what I see and what I've seen for a long time is a need for volunteer lawyers to help parents in particular of their young children who are becoming adults get a guardianship for them. Because as we lawyers know that when a person turns 18, they are, at least in the eyes of the law, considered an adult and they have certain rights. And it also, one of those rights is right to privacy and the right to a patient-doctor relationship that is private. Well, parents can't get into that sphere without some authority. And so when they turn 18, if you have a child with Down syndrome, for example, they need to get a guardian so that the parent can continue to provide the same help that they've always provided, but now for an adult. But many of those parents, unfortunately, can't afford an attorney. But it is absolutely necessary that they get that guardianship because the child needs to have continuing care. And so we've implemented programs through HVL. We've had CLEs. We are working with Houston Young Lawyers, thank goodness, and they're a wonderful group of people to get more volunteer lawyers. And one of the things that I'm continuing to do in probate court, one, is something that I started back when I was a staff attorney here in 2008, and something that Judge Christine Butts continued to do in probate court number four, which is offer a free CLE to attorneys that will get them certified as in guardianships, which is required by law. You have to be certified in guardianships to be able to participate in a guardianship. And the only thing that they need to do is, in return, volunteer for one case through the Houston Volunteer Lawyers. And Houston Volunteer Lawyers offers the same CLE a couple times a year, I believe it is. And I participate on panels there. So we need to get people trained up so that they can help these people, these parents, become guardians for their children and also for children who may need to become guardians for their parents who are challenged with dementia. It is so important because people in guardianships are our most vulnerable population. And without help and assistance of somebody else, they really can't function. And so it is vital, it's necessary for our community that they be able to get a guardian and get one very, very quickly. And of course, the other side of the same coin is that I get excited because we have attorneys who are trained in guardianships. I bring them into probate and I show them that probate is why it is my favorite area of law. And hopefully they will glom on to that and become probate attorneys too, because we certainly need more probate attorneys.
Speaking of which, mm-hmm. what would you say to new and old lawyers alike about becoming involved in guardianship cases from their standpoint? Clearly, you've outlined why society needs the help, but what could you say to encourage them beyond just the desire to help society?
Well, sure. For attorneys, one of the things is you get trained up in a new area of law. You get to explore a new area of law. You are going to be supported by the Houston Volunteer Lawyers, so you're not just trained up and then sent out on your own. But perhaps other than just professionally expanding your horizons, your opportunities, you are also able to give back in a very personal way. So sometimes serving others is rewarding in and of itself. And that could be a personal reward that attorneys can have. And I hope that that they do receive that personal reward. I hope they feel that serving others is a reward in and of itself.
Great. And I must add my bias. I am a member of HYLA, Houston Young Lawyers Association. And although I look old, I am to be a new attorney. I am a relatively new attorney. Within HYLA, what are some activities that you've been involved in to try to get the young attorneys directly involved in the guardianship process?
Well, I have
Or what would you like to do if you haven't yet done?
Well, what I do is I have direct access to them through CLEs. And so I meet with them and hopefully train them up through CLEs. But I also have indirect access to HILA. I certainly enjoy going to their social functions. They have several functions throughout the year at which the judiciary is invited. And I would invite my judicial colleagues to go to HILA events, because I think it is so important that we establish communication with young lawyers, new lawyers, and let them know that, this is not a mysterious process. It may sound mysterious, but get some of that mystery out of the way. But you can also help them with generalized questions about the law, generalized issues. And sometimes we get those cocktail party questions that seem extraordinarily detailed and very specific. Of course, we cannot answer those, but we can be there and encourage them in areas of law that we think are rewarding, that we think are going to be professionally beneficial to young lawyers. And certainly one of the things, and I'll do my plug here too, is that young lawyers, if you're listening out there, probate is the one area of law that in many situations, win or lose, you'll get paid, as long as you maintain a case in good faith, and you can get paid. Now, that's not in everything, but what other area of law can you actually lose a case and still get paid? So that is that's my little plug for probate. Right. That's my little plug for probate, and in particular probate litigation, which is for those of you who may be listening who want to do more than just the uncontested guardianship. Probate litigation is an area that is expanding, but the probate litigators are a finite number, it seems like. So getting into the uncontested areas of guardianship, getting trained up and taking on those cases, perhaps you might see and feel comfortable with litigated cases. And you may become a very fine probate litigator, which we need more. We need more of them.
Great. Is there anything else, Judge Simoneaux, that you would like to tell the audience? Or if people want to get involved, how would you suggest they get involved if they're hearing this for the first time?
Okay. Well, the first thing you need to do is go to Houston Volunteer Lawyers website, and there you can sign up, or you can call Houston Volunteer Lawyers and sign up to be a volunteer lawyer. And this is something that is important on many levels. Number one, our profession has a policy of doing pro bono service. It's not a requirement, but it certainly is a strong advisory. You should do pro bono. It's the noblesse oblige kind of thing. If you are in a position where you have a special talent, a special skill that many others lack, that being you're an attorney, then it is kind of your obligation to give back. And so that's one reason that you probably want to do it. And the other reasons I discussed are expanding your horizons, learning a new area of law, and exploring whether or not this might be a better fit for you than some other thing. And then, of course, the personal reward. So there is no downside at all to signing up for a Houston Volunteer Lawyer. And I'll give you one other thing that I haven't talked about, which is networking. You get to be exposed to a group of other lawyers. In particular, you could have a mentor, for example, from one of the big law firms, or somebody like me who just not when I wasn't a practicing attorney. You'll be exposed to other mentors. So this gets you networking. And one of the byproducts of that is, if you are working with a very experienced attorney who only takes certain cases, they may keep you in mind for cases they really kind of don't want, but feel might be suitable to you. So
Right.
Very good. There's just simply no downside to being a Houston Volunteer Lawyer.
Well, that sounds like some very good advice. And we very much appreciate you, Judge Simoneaux, in participating in Behind the Lines podcast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed being here.
Great.
Thank you so much, Mark and Jez Simoneau, for another great idea for New Year's resolution. We should all think about taking a pro bono case. And thanks to everyone for listening to Behind the Lines, the Houston Lawyer Podcast. We hope you've learned something valuable to enhance your legal profession and life in general from this episode. Talk to you soon, Behind the Lines. Views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the editors of Houston Lawyer or the HBO.